and gentlemen, welcome to the French Connection Special Edition. Today's date is the 20th day of August 2007. My name, of course, is Daryl Bradford Smith. It's great to have you here with me. Events have recently come to my attention about a community in my home state. When I heard what happened in the town council meeting of the community of Watertown, Massachusetts, it's a town on the outskirts of Boston. Wonderful history, this town. Old 1630s it was founded, so it's one of America's oldest communities. There is a large Armenian population in the vicinity of Watertown, and many people in the Armenian community became concerned and then actually angered by the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith's unwillingness to recognize the slaughter of Armenians at the turn of the last century as being a genocide or a Holocaust, if you will. And they felt that there was hypocrisy and duplicitousness in this ADL stand. And the more they tried to push for some sort of explanation or recognition, the more vehement and virulent even the ADL became toward their attempts. And the town council looked into it, and of course, members of it began to get information about the ADL stand on this. And what transpired was that the town finally said that they don't want to participate any longer in the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith's program of this farcical, if you will, in my view, anti-hate program that they've promoted nationwide. Now, of course, what we've understood over time here, and I've through my research, is that in most instances, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith has acted quite opposite to their namesake. And what we're going to do today is bring a little history to the events of the Armenian Massacre. We're going to make them clearer for you so that you all understand that the Armenian Massacre was an event that was in large measure organized and participated in by a Zionist conspiracy. Now, world Zionism at the time was quite young. It had only found its real legs in the Basel meeting of 1897, I believe. And and under Theodore Herzl, but there were plans already underway to undermine the Ottoman Empire. And so I'm going to bring up somebody who's done a great deal of research on this since, a long time ago. We've done about 2 years going on, or even a little less than 2 years. We talked to Mohammed Rafig about this subject and first broached this subject on the Armenian Massacre to the airwaves. So, Mohammed, are you with me?
I'm here, Donald.
It's wonderful to have you back, Mohammed. As usual, you know, we're always trying to move the ball forward here with factual information, with historical and documented information about events of history that have found their effect in our modern lives. And, of course, the Armenian Massacre has to be recognized for what it is. It was a wholesale genocide of a community of people in an area outside of the what today would be called Turkey proper, but was well within the borders of the Ottoman Empire. Can you give us a sketch of the Ottoman Empire and what was going on at that time and how all these things came to be?
Well, firstly, Daryl, I'd like to say that my condolences to the people of the town of in Massachusetts State there who are finding themselves, you know, possibly being relatives and descendants of people who suffered in this genocide, and, you know, finding themselves going against the Anti-Defamation League, who refused to call a spade a spade. Sadly, they do have a history of this, you know, Daryl, when other groups have tried to have themselves recognized as having suffered from this. The Anti-Defamation League, of course, is heavily Zionist run, and as a result of that, they try to keep a bit of a monopoly, don't they, on who's allowed to have a genocide and who isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And this poor little town have run foul of that. And there is an extreme irony as to why the Benaibrich, the Anti-Defamation League, and certain other groups try to keep the Armenian genocide out of the mainstream media and to push these people to one side and belittle their suffering. And that is because, ironically, Darrell, as history shows, Jews were behind it all. And although that may sound a bit fabulous at the moment, we need to, as you quite rightly say, look into the history to understand the claim.
Mm-hmm. Now, what the Turkish Empire, as it's called today, was not a Turkish Empire at all. It was an Ottoman Turk Empire, and it extended from where to where? It was the world's largest empire at the time, was it not?
It was. It was an inheritance of the Caliphate of Islam, which had been running from the days of the Prophet Muhammad through various Arab branches, and eventually it found its way into Turkey. It had been in North Africa, it had been in Egypt, it had obviously been in different parts of the Arabian Peninsula, and eventually the Muslim leadership, the government, found its way into Constantinople.
Mm-hmm.
This particular issue, when the Zionist movement started in the days of Theodor Herzl, and they were looking at how do we get control of this land of Palestine, because that's what Zionism ultimately was about at that stage, or appeared to be about at that stage, wasn't it?
They tried to actually buy from the caliph that area, didn't they?
Well, they didn't. No, they didn't really try to. But I mean, they approached him with a view to purchasing bits of land, and the deal wasn't particularly good enough. But I don't think they ever seriously thought about buying the land from him. They'd already managed to buy certain elements of it, but they just looked at the whole land mass that they wanted for their Zionist repatriation of Jews from the diaspora. This means back to that patch of land. They realized that the whole cost for it was enormous, and it was also a place of great resources. And they realized that the only way to take ownership of this ultimately was to get rid of the current landlord, which of course is the Muslim Caliph. And they began a conspiracy, which is well documented and can be researched on the internet, a conspiracy to overthrow the Caliphate. It was the conspiracy itself manifested inside Turkey under the Young Turk movement, as it was known, run by Kemal Atatürk himself. He was a major player in the Young Turk movement in its influence days, anyway, and eventually went on to become the leader of Turkey, who secularized the whole place.
Now, the term Young Turk, Mohammed, has taken on in today's vernacular the meaning of somebody who is a go-getter and a young, aggressive, that a way to go kind of guy, especially if you're a young Turk on Wall Street. That means, and they use that term, he's a young Turk on Wall Street, somebody who's very aggressive, very go get him, very on top of things, very tough to a tough nut to crack, and very hard nosed. Now, that at the time, was that the way they kind of muscled their way into the caliphate, or what was the history behind these young Turks, and how did they become so powerful within the caliphate's control? I mean, organization.
Well, what the Young Turk movement was outwardly appearing with inside Turkey was, as you say, a bunch of go-getters, people that were trying to push Turkey and Turkic nationalism, and what they were actually doing was turning their back, effectively, on the greater Muslim empire, which was under the control of the caliphate, and they were trying to just focus inwards so that they were only looking at being in charge of Turkey and revitalizing Turkey. What they were saying was, cut off all our management of all the rest of the Muslim empire, let that all go to seed, and let's revitalize Turkey with the Young Turk movement. So it became a nationalist secularist movement. And of course it became quite successful because it ended up with the leadership of Turkey. They convinced the Turks that they were going to be better off with this as a Turkish group if they divested themselves of the wider empire and focused on it. Now the interesting thing is that the Young Turk movement, that was how it appeared outwardly. Inwardly, it was being controlled from Salonika. And Salonika at that time was the most Jewish town in Europe, It had, out of a population of 100,000, 70,000 of the people there were actually Jews. But they weren't ordinary Jews, they weren't open Jews, they were Jews known as Donne, D-O-N-M-E-H, if people want to look that up on
the internet. Is it D-O-E-N or D-O-E-N-M-E-H?
I think there are variant transliterations because it comes from the Turkic itself, but I certainly know it as D-O-N-M-E-H, but it could have other variants.
Okay.
But if people look into this, the Donne, they will find that as a group within Turkey itself, they were a Muslim group outwardly, but were in reality what are known as crypto-Jews, Jews who followed the Sabbatian movement, the movement of a chap called Sabbatai Zevi.
Mm-hmm.
And Sabbatai Zevi was a 17th century messiah to the Jews, or that people among the Jewish community believed he was a messiah. He struck up a million-strong following in the 17th century.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, compared to the population of the world and Asia Minor, that area was massive.
Yep.
When he died and the movement appeared to be fragmenting a bit, he encouraged people, he took the move out to Salonika himself as well, and encouraged them to establish themselves out there, outwardly as practicing Muslims, but on certain days of the week and certain days of the year, practicing their true Sabbatian faith behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of this, because they lived in that area of the world, they were able to speak Turkic languages very fluently, so they blended in as Turks. They had an outward profession of Islam, but secretly were continuing their Sabbatian faith.
Has there been a history of this same action? Wasn't there during Isabella and Ferdinand's Spain, after the Inquisition, that many of the Jews were still staying in Spain, outwardly changed to Christianity, but in the quiet of their own home on the weekends or when on their special holidays, continued their Jewish faith? They were called what? Maranos, yes?
Indeed, they were called Maranos. And in fact, when again, another variety of crypto-Jews, ultimately Sabbatians, but outwardly something else. And, of course, this is what Jacob Frank did, the Frankists, and you'll find across, even within, the irony is, of course, even within Judaism, Darrell, you will find that these people pretend to be a particular type of Jew when, in fact, they're really Sabbatian, because Sabbatian Jews are not even that well recognized within the Jewish community, although in more recent times the Donne have been accepted by Israel, but for officially, but unofficially, they've been accepted all the way down the line, of course, because they pretended to be the types of Jews who rejected themselves, which was all a very strange set of charades. But the thing about this group, I think, for the listeners is to understand that is they're very good at dressing up and pretending to be somebody else. And they masqueraded their way through Masonic lodges, strangely enough, in and the Young Turk movement. The Masonic lodges which they established in Turkey came under diplomatic immunity from an international perspective. And so the caliph was without power against them. And he had to accept that these lodges, these secret meeting places set up under diplomatic immunity, and through those and fronting it through the Young Turk movement, they eventually took over the leadership of Turkey. And the relevance, of course, now back to these people who are trying to make sense of the conduct of the Anti-Defamation League, the problem that they're having, what they didn't understand, was that people within the Anti-Defamation League are aware that it's become an open matter of history now.
Yeah.
That the Young Turk movement was actually Donne Jews who had tied up with one group of Donne Jews that remained in Turkey, another operating out of Salonika who managed it from afar, and that they overthrew and took over the whole Turkish government. And Kemal Atatürk himself was Donmay. He was a crypto Jew.
Again, now, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk is the is considered the father of modern Turkey, and is the one who has limited any access that the population might demand into the Muslim faith. In other words, what he's done is demanded to a point of pedantic control the people of Turkey not to have access to certain Muslim rites and faiths and traditions. Am I correct?
I mean, it went so far, Daniel, it went so far that he even changed the written language. And through one or two generations, the Turkish people who had the old classic right-to-left Semitic language script, it was changed, in fact, to the Roman script and a Romanized version of Turkic, with obviously some vowel pointing and some unusual letter shapes to fully complement it. But he even changed the language. Everybody in Turkey now writes from left to right, as everybody else. But before he came in, people wrote from right to left. They could read Persian or Urdu or Arabic quite easily on sight because they recognized the structure of those languages. I mean, this guy went to such extent that he changed the language of the entire nation to distance themselves from Islam. And of course, the irony is that the Ottoman Caliphate, which had been in place for several hundred years, during that time, the Christians of Armenia had lived in relative security and protection of the caliphate.
Weren't they revered within the Turkish Ottoman Empire as a professional class of well-educated, well-mannered, well-regarded peoples? In other words, I understand also that area governments such as the Russians found the Armenians to be of a very high quality, both morally and educationally.
Indeed, they were a very ancient church. As a Christian group, they go back to the late first, early second century. They speak Aramaic, the language of Jesus, peace be upon him and his mother themselves, or it was the Aramaic church, as it was known. Their version of the New Testament, they have a third century copy, known as the Yodan Codex, which is now found its way into the United States. And that is the oldest known Aramaic New Testament, a 3rd century New Testament. So the church obviously was very well established. It was like the Russian Orthodox. They rejected many innovations of other parts of the church area, like Christmas Day and things like that, being on the 25th of December. So they were very old. They were, as you say, a noble people. Artisan, they were famous for being writers, poets, historians, intellectuals. They were very well known for that. And, yes, you're right, respected by the Muslim community and protected by them. And then all of a sudden, we have, and this is very important for people in that part of the world, we have the takeover by the Donmay. The crypto-Jews come in, they take over the leadership, and sadly now, within not that long, probably one of the most evil bloodletting south of the Caucasus in known history occurred. I believe the estimates are at 1 million men, women, and children that were cold-bloodedly murdered.
Yep.
By that movement.
And didn't they use a series of false flag terrorist attacks within the Turkey proper and blame it on them so that the Turkish Muslims would believe that the people having committed these acts were in fact the Armenians?
The movement that took over Turkey brought about this evil state of affairs by bringing in a large amount of secularism to the people, making them ignorant of facts, making them ignorant of their own history, denying them access to their own history, and then, as you say, Daryl, putting them in a position where they had an enemy where there wasn't an enemy. They deceived the people and then armed them. and then led them into what they thought was a war. And of course, when they got there, the people were in fact unarmed. But by this time, it was very similar to the mass murders which were carried out north of the Caucasus in Russia against the Slavs by the crypto-Jewish movement known as the Bolsheviks. And all historians say the minimum number of people murdered there was 60 million and the top end was 100 million people murdered by this same crypto-Jewish group. So,
yeah.
You know, what methods they used, I think are largely immaterial. It was all deceit, Darrell. That's the only thing we can say.
Well, let me ask you this, Mohammed. Of course, you know, one of the things that if people are hearing this for the first time, they're first going to say that maybe Darrell Bradford Smith and Mohammed Rafik are anti-Semites, or we don't care for Jewish people, or they're going to try to slough off whatever it is being said right now on the grounds that we don't care about the Jewish community, and there could be nothing farther from the truth. And I have prided myself in the facts, firstly, but more importantly, the second fact that I'd like everyone to know listening here, Mohammed, and maybe you can put your own punctuation on this, is that I believe most Jews in the world believe a different story, and they've been told a different story, and they've been retold a different story, and so have the Christians in most of Western Europe and America. And so for so very long, the facts of this stuff have not been able to circulate widely, and so most people believe a very different story about this, and they believe anybody who brings it up to be anti-Semitic. And I'd like you to maybe address this charge that people level against others for anti-Semitism.
Well, of course, this was a very popular technique of the Zionist movement, isn't it, in the last 30 to 40 years, especially, to try and use the label anti-Semite. The irony is that we know that Jewish groups such as the Neturei Carter, the Satmar, the Ida Haredit, different groups of Orthodox Judaism, are the first to say that Zionists deliberately provoke anti-Semitism, and they use anti-Semitism to try and cause fear even in the Jewish community. So it's a two-edged sword. It's trying to make somebody look as if they're a racist or a bigot of some description. And on
yep.
the other side, it's trying to keep the ordinary Jews who are themselves ignorant of a lot of these facts also. What people have to remember is that if these people can take over an entire country such as Turkey and even steal them of their written language and their written history, if they're capable of that, is it really unrealistic to think that they're also not capable of managing the way in which their message and the reality of events is conveyed elsewhere? Of course they can. And this is why today the Anti-Defamation League, I would imagine there may be even members there, possibly even members in there, who themselves just live in a perpetual state of fear, and don't really understand that they're being manipulated by this group. And that in itself is also a sadness. But as for being a bigot or a racist, which is the implied statement, that, of course, is nonsense. We're discussing here the plight of the Armenians. And
yep.
what is bigoted and racist is refusal to recognize the mass murder which they endured, and that their descendants have lost so much material wealth and displacement and suffering in the world, the refusal by this group to call it what it really is. And you know, they can wiggle and they can squirm and they can say, well, we're trying to say that we're acknowledging it, but we don't want to affirm it, or whatever their statements are. Ultimately, it's bigotry, because they're saying, we can have a genocide, but nobody else can. We can have a Holocaust, but nobody else can. That's true racism. That's true bigotry. Because
well, interesting, though, that most of the largest and most the devastating genocides in the last 150 years have their roots in the Zionist Jewish community. And I'll give you a couple of names here. We've got a Vladimir Jabotinsky. We've got how about Alexander Israel Lazarevich Halfin. We've got Lev Bromstein or Leon Trotsky. We've got enough in the Bolshevik side of things and in the Salonika side of things to prove these are not musings of either of us, but rather proof positive that this group is bent on something rather sinister here. And in order to point it out, many people take great personal risk to do so. And when Watertown came up and said something is wrong here, Muhammad, about the way that this Anti-Defamation League is fighting tooth and nail to not allow us to even look into this Armenian massacre and this Armenian genocide, something's wrong. And I don't think they understand the full story. That this is far more horrible a history than they realize.
Of course, Daryl. I mean, it's unpleasant enough to see the genocide, but when you start realizing that the people who were engaged in that and involved in the actual slaughter process themselves had been deceived by a very mischievous group who took control of the whole thing and caused them to commit those crimes, and I'm not saying for one moment they weren't crimes, because they were, but when we look at the instigators behind it and the cause and the rationale, we find that it wasn't actually people who were Muslim or from the Muslim faith. They were actually crypto-Jews pretending to be Muslim, and crypto-Jews, as anybody who looks into the subject of crypto-Jews will find out, are quite happy to pretend to be Christians, pretend to be atheists, pretend to be Jews of different groups and sects. They're very, very comfortable with that because they believe that it's something that was sanctioned by their Messiah himself, and that all of their Messiahs advocate the practice of this. Very, very sad for these people in Watertown to be going up against the Anti-Defamation League, but they must understand that what they're doing is correct, what they're saying about the genocide is correct. They have every right for this to be labelled and termed a genocide, and they have every right also to understand who were the instigators and architects of that particular evil atrocity.
Well, you know, we look at this stuff and we talk about, again, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk and his control of that nation through the 1920s period, through World War One and Two, all the way up until I think he passed on in when, the 50s, 40s?
I think it was maybe 60s even now. I can't remember the precise date offhand. I apologize for that.
But he, now what's happened is the Turkish nation is still firmly under the grip of his crypto-Zionist Jewish controllers. Is it not?
Indeed, the legacy which he has left was easy for people to try and keep the same way, and that's why, you know, inside of Turkey today, we've had groups like the Refa Party and various other Islamist groups who are trying to restore back some of the original history and pride of the days when they now don't look just at nationalism; they look at the days when maybe they had an empire and they were once great, and realize that the Young Turk movement actually has sold them into nothing. They can't even get into the euro, can they? I mean, they've become nothing as a country, and from having great power and dominion in the world, as if when they look objectively, externally, at what they're left with, they don't have very much.
How many Turks are aware of this history?
Yeah, there are a small number who've had access to the libraries of the West, Darrell. I've met quite a few people from Turkey myself here in the UK, and they've been able to study it. But, of course, you cannot discuss this stuff inside of Turkey. You would get assassinated. And a lot of these Muslims feel very bad when they discover that the whole Armenian genocide was slaughtered for and on behalf of crypto-Jews. You know, they feel very, very bad indeed. And I'm sure that they wouldn't have any objection to the reality of history coming out, and that the people of Armenia being able to commemorate the suffering and the loss that they had. I don't think that they as Muslims would object to that, but we find that the group inside of Turkey which struggles against this coming out is again the secularist movement, which is descended.
That's the military basically controlling that, is it not?
The military have a disproportionate amount of control in Turkey, so that whichever government gets in, the generals all appear to come from the southeast of Turkey, and in a particular tribe of Alawis down there, and that at one stage, something like 90% of them were from one tribe only. Again, this is all part of the control mechanism which the crypto-Jews have left in place. And of course now the crypto-Jewish movement, the Donne movement, has been accepted officially by world Jewry, and they can now make their return to Palestine, even though their descendants have never been there. They've been allowed to return to a place they've never previously been. So the proof of the pudding, if people want to know whether this is all true, you can even see that the official Jewish movements in the world, Orthodox movements, didn't recognize these people, but have in the 1920s and maybe 30s, but have officially now come out with the equivalent of their Jewish fatwa to say that no, we accept them officially now as part of the Jewish community, and that they can also return to Palestine.
Well, you know, one of the things I wanted to do with this file is to give a thumbnail sketch of the importance of this information, of Watertown's experience here, and not really over dramatize or over complicate the facts. Are there some places you could maybe point the listener to doing some additional research on these facts, so that in the event that they do take an interest, and I think many members of Watertown's population are going to take an interest in this, but if they want to, where would they find information on this? Other than the internet, are there some definitive books that haven't been written, or things that you could maybe point them to?
One book that I'm aware of, but it's not easy to get hold of. Sadly, a lot of people who wrote books on this maybe 15, 20 years ago, comparatively recently, it's difficult to get hold of those books. You know, they got labeled as anti-Semitic and were pushed out. But you will find in the main, even Catholic encyclopedias and all the main sort of research resources in the world, you can read all about the Donne. You can read about, as you were mentioning, the Murano. You'll find the concept of crypto-Jews discussed very widely. In specifics, and the Young Turk movement, probably the best book on it was a book called Satanic Voices, Ancient and Modern, which was compiled by David Pidcock, but sadly not easily available. But he's got all the references to famous British historians who covered these matters, and also the diaries of the Grand Orient Lodges, which became opened and made publicly available, and which were quoted by famous members of the British aristocracy in their own biographies. So these things are publicly available, but still in small supply, I'm afraid.
Well, you know that I'm a friend of David Pidcock's, don't you?
Yes, indeed, yes.
Yes, and David, his work on this area, I think he was really stating, you know, obvious facts to anybody who's looked into it. But because of the power of the financial control of this group that's being discussed, many of the publications that have ever tried to speak about it have been, well, they can't find a publisher, they can't find a distributor, or they get bought out, or something happens to them, they're eliminated. In other words, it's very difficult to get any traction on this story, because most of the enterprises that would be printing or distributing these books are in the hands of the very people that you're discussing.
Yes, and of course, when David's book was going to be reviewed at the Independent newspaper, the journalist who worked for the Independent newspaper of London, the copy of his book about specifically the army, which covered a lot to do with the Turk movement and the Armenian atrocity, the book was actually stolen from his desk in the office. It was actually stolen in the...
The original manuscript.
The copy of the book which he'd been given was stolen off his desk.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, inside the office. That's a fact, and I knew David at the time that occurred. But, again, all the sources which David quotes in his book are all easily available sources. There are many others if you look on the net, but I think the most important thing is just to look into the issue of the Donmay and their links to the Young Turk movement, because that is...
Well, are you aware that that the president of France is a Donmay Turk?
I didn't know that.
His family roots are in Salonika, Greece.
Ah, well, that's highly probable then, because Salonika, you know, according to Jewish yearbook, I think of 1905, was the most Jewish town in Europe, of a population of 100,000. They said that there was more than 70,000 of the people were Jewish. And that's why the Young Turk, again, easily verifiable facts. And that's why the Young Turk movement was operated from there. It was the safest base in Europe to operate from.
Now, are these people were they in direct contact with the Lev Bronsteins and the Trotskyites that were running the Russian massacres? And were they also in contact with the Jewish community in America through their New York and Chicago bases?
The person who was the link between all those groups, you've asked a very deep and very deep and important question there, Dal, something that people don't normally ask. The link between all three groups, if you want to know one man who was in contact with all three of them in the early days, you would find Theodor Herzl. He was the man who was trying to run the coordination of these elements, and the whole point of the 1897 Basel meeting was to try and draw in large numbers of the international Jewish community that were ready to move around to act as his wires, I suppose, that you would call them in the United States, where the race wires were reporting back information. And he tried to form a communication movement, and the whole Basel conference was put together to try and create a communications group, and he was central to that. And the instructions were coming from New York, ultimately, yes.
Well, and another gentleman named Alexander Israel Lazarevich Helfrand, a.k.a. Parvis.
Parvis. He was definitely involved in it, too. But
he was the bag man between all of them, wasn't he?
There was the man whose job was running the money around, I think, maybe. Yes.
Well, he's got his fingers on that $20 million that went to the group that went over to Russia in 1916, if I'm not mistaken.
If you look at the fact that the two ships which were left in the east side of New York for the Russian Revolution and that were actually held off the Russian coast for a short period of time, and once the revolution kicked forward for real, about 2,000 of them, I think, in total, landed. All well-known history. But the point is that Herzl put the communications together, that he was running the communications backwards and forwards. The man who actually ran the money out from the States is the man who, on his deathbed, bragged of funding the Russian Revolution.
Mm-hmm. And who was that?
Well, that man was a very famous banker, Mr. Schiff, Mr. Jacob Schiff.
Yes.
And Mr. Jacob Schiff bragged on his deathbed that he was the man who put $20 million of his own money into financing the Russian Revolution, a claim he made himself, which all the historians have documented.
He was also one of the founders of the Federal Reserve System.
That's right, yeah. All these things have links.
Oh, a tangled web we weave. And you know, to say these things today... people who have been indoctrinated into this idea that to speak like this is anti-Semitic, many of them are probably going to sit in their chairs and go, oh, and cringe. And not dissimilar to the way I responded when I first became aware of some of these facts, Muhammad, because you have almost a Pavlovian response to these facts. And as you become more aware of just how tangled this web really is in world history and how much of it has been hidden, there is a mixture of disbelief and disgust that erupts inside of you. And some of it is because you can't believe that you wouldn't have known this. And the other side of it is you know it's real, you know it's true, and you become revolted by the idea that this is the value that has been placed on human life by a particular group of fanatics.
Indeed, and this links straight back into the poor folks out at Watertown there who must be experiencing those same emotions, Darrell, you know, this disbelief and incredulity. How can we possibly, trying to discuss this massacre of our ancestors, how can people talk about it in such a callous way? How can people refuse to recognize the legitimacy of our suffering and our loss? And yet, they are experiencing it firsthand. And in reality, that's the first bit of evidence that they should take on board when thinking, don't dismiss what you're hearing today. Go and look at it for yourselves. Look into the terms that we've given. It's easy on the net now. A lot of it's very easily accessible at the speed of light. You don't have to go into obscure libraries around the world anymore. This stuff is a lot easier to get hold of. And look into who was really behind the Armenian massacre. And you will find that the same people who are refusing to give legitimacy to the loss and suffering and destruction which occurred back then are defending the people that they know really perpetrated it, and that's what their agenda is. The reason they can't do this, it's not just the monopolization of the word genocide, it's also because they know that members of the community had a hand in it, and it's a very, very difficult subject for them.
Well, we've touched on it very very broadly. And I would like to thank you, Muhammad, for doing this with me this day. Again, you've been instrumental in providing many important files for us to share with our listeners. But to do this for Watertown, and of course, Watertown is going to receive a lot of attention over the next weeks and possibly months regarding their stand. It is my greatest hope that community can weather the attack that's going to be leveled against them as a result of their stand. And my hope is that other communities around Massachusetts and the United States and Western Europe can re-examine this entire history and start to understand that we are facing a terrible reality, and that is that there is a group that works in the shadows, that has worked in the shadows for centuries, to undermine the cohesiveness of communities around the world, and it is happening in modern times to other people, not just the Armenians. Now we're moving up to modern day, and these same forces are at work again. And I'd like to point out to everybody that there is a powerful history to be learned, and this is maybe your introduction to it. And I want to thank you, Muhammad, for coming in and doing that today with me.
You're most welcome, Darrell.
Thanks again, Muhammad. Ladies and gentlemen, this is an important subject for every American and every European to know. There are Armenians across Western Europe and across the United States who have cried out for justice on that slaughter. And there are other communities of equal importance that need justice as well. And we need to explain to them how this has happened to them and who has been the perpetrators of this. And unless and until we can get justice, there will never be satisfaction here, and there never will be an end to the investigations. So, ladies and gentlemen, please do your due diligence, do your fair share of the investigating so that you understand the facts. Until the next time, my name is Darrell Bradford Smith, telling you all, please be well. Bye-bye now.